One aspect of George Washington's Christianity that's often overlooked is the fact that he absolutely insisted on chaplains. We're going to talk about that right now during this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is returning Dr. Peter Lilback, who is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary, and he and I had the privilege to write a book that became a bestseller called George Washington's Sacred Fire. It's a 1,200-page book dedicated to documenting that, frankly, George Washington was a Christian, despite what some people say today, and showing that with documentation here and there and everywhere. All right, Dr. Lilback, welcome back to the program. Great to have you on again.
Jerry, I love our fellowship. Thanks for all your hard work to advance the cause of Christ's impact on culture. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Well, thank you. All right, let's focus on George Washington and chaplains. And I guess most of the ones we'd be talking about would be in the military, but later, if you wish, we could even mention legislative chaplains. But I understand that even as a young man, even before this country became a nation, when he was serving in what we now call the French and Indian War, he believed in chaplains. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's really interesting. As the French and Indian War was raging, which today would be especially in the western part of the state of Pennsylvania, in those days they thought that was still part of Virginia. This is a vast territory and all the boundaries hadn't been worked out yet. When Washington is now in the British military, he's leading British soldiers as a young colonel, fighting with the French, fighting with the Indians. There is this series of letters and pleas that goes back to his commanding officers that are in Virginia, and he basically says to them, we need to have chaplains. We cannot be viewed as so heathen that we don't care about spiritual things. He recognized that for the military to be an orderly group of people who would follow orders, people who are ready to lay down their lives because of what they were fighting for, that spiritual truths had to be part of their lives, and that was the function of a chaplain. He was concerned then that if men are going to die, that they have their faith nurtured as they're getting ready to lay down their lives. If men are going to be faithful to keep order and structure, they need to be people who are committed to doing what's right and wrong. And further, he realized when there is no chaplain, that meant that the chaplain duties that were required in the British military had to be performed by the officers who were in charge, officers who did not have theological training, officers who were not designed to be Bible teachers and preachers who could just simply take the Book of Common Prayer and lead a worship service, and Washington was quite willing to do that. I think we've mentioned in other shows how Washington actually had his own personal copy of the Book of Common Prayer that he carried with him, sized so it would be convenient to bring along. So he would do that, and he actually did serve as a chaplain when General Braddock was mortally wounded in the French and Indian War outside of Pittsburgh. So clearly, Washington was already committed to chaplains from the beginning of his military career. Now, when you go years later,
Can I just stop you real fast? I understand that he was even rebuked one time by one of the British while he was serving the British on American soil in that French and Indian War. He said, hey, we need more chaplains or something, and some higher-up wrote him and said, forget it, you know, or something like that. Tell us about that. I thought that was interesting.
Well, basically, the problem with having chaplains, whether in the French and Indian War or in the Revolution, is twofold. One, you need to have a supply of people who can do it. They had to be trained and prepared to serve in the military. And obviously, theologically trained people were hard to get for the churches in Virginia, let alone for military service in the wilderness in Virginia. So they were having trouble getting the pastorates filled in the hinterlands of the Virginia across the ocean, far away from the comforts of the United Kingdom and London. Secondly, not only was it hard to get people, but if you got them there, it also cost something. You had to pay their salaries. You had to provide for their support. And so there were two grounds right from the beginning, and the same issues came up later in the American Revolution under Washington's command, is that we can't afford this. It's too expensive. Secondly, we can't get the right people to do it. So that was the reason that they said, just go do your job, don't need it. And Washington is saying, we need this if we're going to have an effective military. So when you fast forward then to the American Revolution, mm-hmm. no longer would there be Anglican chaplains leading now. There would be all the different traditions that were part of the American Revolution. There were different traditions that, because there were different soldiers coming from different colonies that had spiritual interests, and they were welcomed. So that was the beginning of recognizing a legitimate ecumenical presence in the military, that different chaplains from different traditions were welcome. But the Congress also had problems just paying their regular soldiers. And even in the time of inadequate finances, Washington said, we must have chaplains, we must find funds for them. So the fact that there are military chaplains to this day in the American Armed Forces goes back to our founding father, who as a young soldier and then as the commander of the Revolutionary Forces insisted that the chaplain had a significant role. And then taking a few steps further, it's interesting that Washington actually, with military funds, provided for some of the sermons that were preached by some of the chaplains to be printed and distributed to the soldiers to read, so that the message and the theology and the patriotism woven together would help to nurture the soldiers. And then there's one particularly interesting one, and we have this as an appendix in our book, is that Washington had one young particular chaplain that he admired very greatly. And he asked him to write a prayer for the American military, which was written, and it became, if you will, kind of like the common prayer for the worship of the army. And that is actually published in our book, and Washington saw to it that that was paid by military funds, because he wanted his soldiers to be, as he said, in his general orders at Valley Forge, I want my men to be Christian soldiers. He actually uses those words. Further, he says, how can we expect God to bless our arms if we are cursing the very name of the God whose providence is going to bless us in battle? And then finally, he says in a general order to all of his men, while you're adding to your character the great title of patriot, add the higher virtue of being a Christian. Washington saw being a Christian as even a higher quality in his soldiers than being patriotic soldiers, because he believed a true Christian was not only a patriot, but a man of principle, a man who was willing to fight for what was just, to believe God to protect him, and one who was willing, if necessary, even to lay down his life for a cause that was bigger than himself, because of the love that a Christian has for his neighbor and for his country and for his God. So Washington saw the chaplain as absolutely essential for the well-being of the military. And if I can keep going,
yeah, keep going.
Today, far after Washington, we know there's a tremendous effort to get the military to remove all religious chaplaincies. They're working hard to say, we don't want to pay for this. It's an establishment of religion. And yet, we are seeing all the struggles that our men are having, our women are having with redeployment, the ongoing, never-ending battle with the struggle against terrorism and instability in the world. And there's a whole new movement that's beginning to address that. I've heard the working title is Faith Works. What that means is that somehow when a soldier has faith, when he believes in God and believes in God's blessing and God's wisdom, he is a much healthier soldier. Isn't that interesting? In a day where we're trying to secularize everything, we're seeing the melding down of soldiers and the lack of their spiritual nurture. And there's an argument that's beginning to be established with empirical evidence that the soldiers that function the best are those who have a living faith that gives them a way to deal with all the crises, adversities, and difficulties that every soldier confronts, whether in deployment or actual combat. And so that's exactly what I think Washington was on to long ago. He understood a better soldier is one who is spiritually supported, not just militarily and physically supported. So the chaplaincy exists to this day in many ways because of the deep commitment that General Washington and President Washington had for the importance of spiritual nurture of our combat people.
Where could people get more information on that new empirical evidence you were just referring to?
Well, they can certainly contact us at providenceforum.org.
Okay.
I'm pleased to say, and I'd like to introduce to your listeners, we have now a new strategic director of the Providence Forum. His name is Reverend John Kenyon, K-E-N-Y-O-N. He's a Presbyterian minister. He's just retired, I believe, as a lieutenant colonel from the Air Force, having served for many years as a chaplain. And he's going to be doing a Doctor of Ministry study at Westminster. And part of his vision is trying to talk about First Amendment rights and chaplains in the military, which is part of the contested area. And he's the one who's been sharing with me how important this new movement is. So if people would like to know more, contact us at Providence Forum, and I will have John Kenyon share some of the updated information and basis for this new movement.
You know, you mentioned the First Amendment. I was just going to ask you, as I listened to you describing all these things about what George Washington did with chaplains, and you can't help but think, well, what about the separation of church and state?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is the way that they understood it, and the way I think we should still understand it, is that the separation of church and state, again, a phrase not found in the Constitution, it's an interpretation of the First Amendment that goes back to Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists in the early 1800s. So it's a way the courts have tried to describe the clauses between church and religion in the First Amendment. But what we need to see is that their view of whatever that separation of church and state meant, it did not mean a separation of God and government. See, we must be sure that we are making a distinction between liturgical church life and philosophical views of ultimate reality. They're two different things. A person who doesn't believe in the church at all needs to realize our founders saw government as something that was operating under a transcendent authority. That's why in the Declaration of Independence, God is referred to on four different occasions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important principle that we must not lose. The separation of church and state does not mean the separation of God and government. And that is why that providing for the different views of religious life by our soldiers in the American context has always been a significant concern of the chaplaincy. We need to remember there are Roman Catholics. We need to remember that there are Protestants. Today we need to realize there are Jews. And even more now, we need to realize there are Muslims. The military has shown us that we are not establishing a religion, but rather we're serving the spiritual needs of all of our soldiers because we recognize, historically at least, that God and government are not to be separated. But if there's someone who's part of government who does not want to exercise worship in God, no one's compelled to go. You can be an atheist in the military and do just fine. But the military cannot become a secular, practical atheist organization and be what America was intended to be, which is a place for the free exercise of religion, including our military. And that's why the chaplain's expressions are not mandatory, but they are provided, and they have the full diversity of the different religious traditions that exist within the American Armed Forces.
Excellent. Okay, now we have 1 minute to wrap up. How about a comment about legislative chaplains? Any link there to George Washington?
No question about it. Washington knew that there were chaplains that were functioning in the early Congress when he was actually leading. And there are actually letters that go between the chaplains of the early Congress in Washington, and there were close relationships where they would dine together in fellowship. So we know that Washington welcomed the chaplains even in the legislative halls, which included William White, John Rogers. William White was from Christ Church, Philadelphia, and so an Episcopalian. John Rogers was a Presbyterian from Philadelphia. So there was this recognition of the importance of spiritual life, even in the Congress, and they were welcomed. And the leading and opening in prayer has always been part of our legislatures, taking oaths with hands upon the Bible, something that Washington did. In fact, when he took his oath, he bent over and kissed the Bible, following the Anglican custom when he took his oath of office as the president. So chaplains have always been part of our system right from the beginning, even in the governmental expression of our life.
Dr. Lilbeck, thanks again for joining us. Providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you and God bless you.